KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Aid trucks are heading into Gaza, and some displaced people are heading home. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is holding. We'll hear from a doctor about the humanitarian crisis left after 15 months of war. For Sunday, January 26th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ping Huang. President Trump seeks to take down DEI programs across the government. He calls them illegal. A civil rights advocate pushes back.
These efforts are seeking to tether the spirit of the law with the letter of the law.
An AI judge helped score snowboarding at this weekend's X Games. We'll hear how it went. And with Lunar New Year coming up, we'll talk about a performance you'll see at celebrations around the world, the lion dance.
Move the lion head in a certain way, and then that is supposed to convey like a little bit of a playfulness or a cheeky vibe.
Those stories and more coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump is taking retaliatory action against Colombia, a U.S. ally, after the country refused to allow two military deportation planes from the U.S. to land. And now Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, says he will respond in kind with tariffs on U.S. goods. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
In a post on Truth Social, Trump said the Colombian leader's decision has, quote, jeopardized the national security and public safety of the United States. He laid out a handful of measures, including a 25% tariff on Colombian goods that would rise to 50% the following week. The move, Trump says, would also enact a travel ban and revoke visas for Colombian government officials, as well as impose additional financial sanctions and ramp up inspections of Colombian citizens and cargo at the border. These measures, Trump says, are just the beginning. The Colombian government has put out another statement saying they would provide a presidential plane for migrants. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is denying that software company Oracle is planning to take over TikTok. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, Trump's comments come despite senior White House officials discussing an Oracle deal to save the video app.
When asked on Air Force One about an NPR report describing how Oracle was working on a deal to put up tens of billions of dollars for a large stake in TikTok, Trump was dismissive. Trump said he hasn't talked to Larry about it. That's Larry Ellison, founder and chairman of Oracle. Some context. Trump tried to broker a deal to sell TikTok to Ellison in his first term. Trump said just days ago, quote, I'd like Larry to buy it about TikTok. And Oracle already has a huge contract with TikTok for web hosting. Two people involved with the White House talks who weren't authorized to speak publicly told NPR Oracle, Microsoft, and other investors are putting together a deal to buy out TikTok's Chinese stake. Negotiators say under the deal, Oracle would have oversight of the app's data, algorithm, and software updates. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Much-needed rain is falling across parts of Southern California, helping firefighters as they make progress in containing wildfires. But it's raising worries of mudslides and toxic ash. NPR's Chandelise Duster reports thunderstorms could bring heavy downpours and gusty winds.
The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch parts of Los Angeles County scorched by the fires. And officials are cautioning those who return to their homes to be careful of toxic material. Los Angeles County Department of Public Health Director Dr. Barbara Furrier.
Heavy metals such as lead and arsenic can come from burned electronics and building materials, and even a brief exposure can potentially cause skin irritations and lead to more serious illness.
Residents are also advised to wear an N95 mask to not inhale smoke and ash. Chandelise Duster, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. French President Emmanuel Macron will visit the Louvre this week amid reports that the world's most visited museum is deteriorating. And here's Eleanor Beardsley has more.
A leaky roof and a dangerous lack of temperature control were among a list of complaints detailed by the museum's director to the culture minister in a letter obtained by the French press.
The Louvre is like a leaky aircraft carrier.
That's New York Times journalist Elaine Sciolino, whose new book on the Louvre will be out in April. She says architect I.M. Pei's iconic glass pyramid at the museum's entrance is not helping matters either.
The pyramid, which everybody loves and is supposed to be modernité and everything, is in terrible shape. There's a greenhouse effect. So it's hot. It's noisy.
Set up to receive 4 million visitors a year, the Louvre welcomes twice that many, The director called for a separate entrance for Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa, which is thronged by visitors all day long. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Latvia is reaching out to Sweden and other Baltic Sea allies in NATO for assistance as it investigates the cause of damage to an underwater fiber optic data cable running to Sweden. The country's prime minister said on X today that a data cable running on the seabed to Sweden has been damaged in Swedish waters. Latvia, Sweden, and other NATO allies in the region are investigating and increasing patrols in that area. U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. Dow futures down about 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are down about 1.5%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ping Huang, in for Scott Detrow. A fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is holding. There's been a surge in aid into Gaza this past week, and people there are slowly returning to demolished cities that Israeli troops have withdrawn from. The deal has also secured the release of some Israelis taken hostage by Hamas and Palestinians held by Israel. With more on all this, we're joined now by NPR correspondent Aya Batrawi in Dubai. Aya, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So one of the most complex parts of the ceasefire are the prisoner exchanges happening. Tell us about the swap that happened yesterday.
Yes, these are really complex. So in total, 7 Israeli women have been released from captivity in Gaza since this deal was struck a week ago, and 4 of them were released yesterday. These are 4 female soldiers taken hostage to Gaza in the October 7th attack on Israel nearly 16 months ago. Here's the sound of one of the young women, Liri Elbag's emotional reunion with her parents in Israel yesterday. Now, on the Palestinian side, around 300 people in total have been freed by Israel. These are among thousands held in Israeli prisons. About a third of these have been women and some boys under the age of 18 held without charge. But yesterday saw the release of Palestinian men serving long sentences, some of them for crimes of murder and attacks on Israelis. Now, dozens were released into exile, so not into Palestinian territories. But NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, captured Chance in support of Hamas's military wing, Izzeddin, as a few of the prisoners arrived in Gaza for their release.
Hey, let's stay in Gaza. What can you tell us about what this past week has been like for Palestinians there?
I mean, people are absolutely exhausted after 16 months of war and tens of thousands of people killed, most of them women and children, according to Gaza's health ministry. And the figures now starting to come out of Gaza are staggering. The UN says there are around 35,000 children who have had one or both parents killed in this war, and that at least 20% of the population of Gaza now have permanent disabilities, with thousands of children having lost one or both legs in Israeli bombardment. And even with this grim reality, there's still a sense of relief across Gaza that the war, that Israeli airstrikes have stopped since the ceasefire came into effect a week ago. And part of this deal means that much more aid now is flowing into Gaza. In just the first 3 days of the ceasefire, more food aid entered Gaza than the entire month of October, according to the UN Humanitarian Relief Agency. But another thing that happened was some people were finally able to return to their cities and assess the damage to their homes. But what most of them found was rubble and destruction. Hospitals, schools, roads, everything charred, unrecognizable from Israeli airstrikes and bulldozers throughout the war.
That brings me to something President Trump told reporters yesterday. He called the Gaza Strip a real mess and a demolition site. And he said he wants Jordan and Egypt to take in Palestinians from the territory. But we know that they and other Arab states are opposed to displacement. So how are Trump's comments being received in Gaza?
Yeah, and he also said this displacement could be temporary or long term. He said, quote, "We just clean out the whole thing." But he said this as tens of thousands of people in Gaza are waiting in the cold since last night with their few belongings for Israel to approve for them to move from central and southern Gaza, where they've been displaced for the whole war, back to Gaza City and areas of the north. Now, NPR producer again, Anas Baba, he saw babies bundled up, elderly people sleeping on the road, expecting, just hoping to be able to return today, even if they don't have homes to go back to. Tahrid Abu Aklin, a 46-year-old mother, was among the large crowds waiting to return with her daughters. She said, "We will return to Gaza City no matter what." And while she says returning to her city will feel like a win, she says this is not a victory. Too many innocent people, too many children, she says, have been killed to call this a victory.
That's NPR's Aya Batraoui. Aya, thank you.
Thank you.
Just days into his second administration, President Donald Trump has signed several sweeping executive actions to end federal DEI programs, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Trump has called DEI illegal, immoral, and discriminatory, but the history of these programs spans decades, rooted in attempts to address inequalities and bolster equal opportunities for employment. To learn more about the history of federal DEI policies, I spoke with Timothy Welbeck. He's director of Temple University's Center for Anti-Racism, and he started with the basics.
DEI is an acronym. It stands for Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and if you add the A, it also stands for accessibility. And these are a set of policies that first began in part with the federal government to ensure that federal employment was making an effort to ensure that there was no discrimination against people on the basis of their race, their color, creed, national origin, things of that nature. President Kennedy issued an executive order in 1961. That's what many people signal as the beginning of the affirmative action era, because he literally used the phrase affirmative action in that executive order. And then President Johnson issued a similar order in 1965, and both of which can be surmised to say that the federal government or federal contractors were not to discriminate against employees or potential employees based on their race, their national origin, and other things that we now refer to as protected classes.
Yeah, say a little bit more about that. Like, what is the philosophy behind DEI at the federal level?
At the federal level, it begins with, in part, tackling our history of racism and discrimination and ensuring that the federal government is no longer a proprietor of discrimination, particularly on the basis of race. And so these executive orders that launched much of this conversation in many ways were stemming from what we refer to as the Civil Rights Era and the Freedom Era, which brought to the forefront of our nation's attention many of the grievances of segregation and how it impacted people's lives. And so as it relates to that, the federal government has taken at times, based on various administrations, efforts to try to undo some of the harm of this segregation, much of which in prior eras was propagated by the federal government.
President Trump has called DEI programs illegal. He says they violate federal civil rights. But for a long time and for a lot of people, DEI programs are seen as the necessary and logical extension of civil rights laws. So how can both of these things be true?
Well, both of them aren't true. President Trump has mischaracterized DEI initiatives in part because he has antagonism towards them. And as he signaled during his presidential campaign, this was a priority of his. But these efforts are seeking to tether the spirit of the law with the letter of the law. So much of the equal protections that we see in clauses like the 14th Amendment or the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the ADA, and other types of legislation were seeking to not only undo historic and systemic harm, but it was also seeking to ensure that going forward, there would be no further types of discrimination in that vein.
Trump has said that he wants to, quote, forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based, which I think, you know, is sort of the spirit of it. And critics say that the idea that someone's success is, you know, based solely on their accomplishments is just an idea that does not work. But still, you know, baked into the American dream is the whole idea that you can accomplish anything if you study hard and work hard. What are your thoughts on sort of like, you know, how these things kind of exist together?
The United States Can I say that it's fully been a meritocracy when we have 249 years of slavery, 90 years of racialized segregation, and barred women from entering into the workforce in meaningful ways for much of our nation's history? That's not a meritocracy, denying people access and opportunities regardless of whether they're qualified. When we look at this conversation around merit, it's often thinly veiled attempts to try to undo various ways that have opened up opportunities for those who historically were denied them. And so whether it's this conversation here or talking about colorblindness as a whole, a lot of it has its roots in trying to undo the progress that has been made with some of these initiatives.
I mean, there has been this long history of DEI programs, and that has, you know, brought us to a place where there are lots of people of different colors and beliefs and positions of, you know, prominence and power. So why do we still need these programs?
First, we still need these programs because we haven't given them adequate time to work. We're only a generation and a half into these policies, and they have met opposition literally from their inception. So whether there is litigation, whether there is rhetoric emanating from opponents, there's been opposition from the beginning. So one, we haven't given them enough time to fully actualize their mission and their goals. Secondly, we've seen that when there is a regression in these protections, the need for the protection becomes more pronounced. If we continue to roll back some of these protections with DEI, we're going to see increases in discriminations because there will no longer be the types of protections that are in place to ensure equal access and opportunity.
So I want to sort of take stock of where we are and where we're going. So, you know, throughout history, groups of Americans outside of the government have pushed leadership to acknowledge racism and sexism and biases against disabled people and the LGBT community, and to really push leadership towards policies like DEI. This is something that has taken tremendous effort, and in many cases, it's not something that the government has done willingly. So where do things go from here if these measures are rolled back?
What I would continue to encourage people across the nation, particularly the private sector and those at the state and local level, is to hold diversity, equity, and inclusion as a value, and to remember that these are policies that are aimed at offering meaningful opportunities to all people. At times, there may need to be creative ways to implement that, but I would encourage people not to shy away from that going forward. It's a necessary thing, and it's also something that we should celebrate. We should value the idea of multi-perspectives when we are trying to solve problems. We should value the idea of including as many people as possible. And so, yes, there are shifts in the federal government that are happening right now, but I would encourage people to deepen their resolve and commitment to these values.
That is Timothy Welbeck, Director of Temple University's Center for Anti-Racism. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump says he's imposing retaliatory measures on Colombia after the U.S. ally refused to allow a military deportation plane from the U.S. to land. That includes an immediate 25% tariff that will rise to 50% in a week, along with visa restrictions on Colombia officials. The CIA is offering a new assessment of the origins of the pandemic. The agency released a report completed under the Biden administration that gives more credence to the virus having leaked from a Chinese lab, but acknowledges low confidence in its findings and that a natural origin remains plausible. And at the weekend box office, Flight Risk debuted in the top spot with a modest $12 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ping Huang. You've probably heard that the internet is forever, but is it really? You've probably also lost access to some of the things that you've loved on the internet. A blog that went dark, an account you're locked out of, or some funny video that's just vanished. Writer S.E. Smith calls for giving more thought into what gets kept and lost on the internet and wrote about it for the tech news site The Verge. Welcome, S.E.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we think of the internet as forever, like a place where old posts and photos can come back and haunt us. Is that no longer true?
It is definitely no longer true. There's a concept known as digital decay, which refers to online media just kind of disappearing for a variety of reasons. Pew recently did a study showing that about 40% of websites since about 2013 have just vanished. They are inaccessible. There's a maze of dead links that go nowhere. So there's an idea that, oh, if I put it out there, it will be online forever. I can always find it again. An employer can always find it. And that's just really not the case, especially now that we're in this kind of app-based world where you don't control your content.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a really basic sense, like what happened? Like where has all the content gone?
Some of this is happening because organizations go out of business. So you have servers going offline. You have people deciding to remove their own content. You have organizations taking down old content or putting up a paywall. You have, as we're seeing with the federal government right now, a lot of quote-unquote archiving of material that is pulled offline. So you go to look something up at, say, the NIH, and what you get is a 404. In terms of what levels is gone, some of that information really is gone.
I mean, I feel like in the early years of the internet, like preserving every scrap was some kind of a goal, you know, someone's goal. I mean, the Library of Congress archived like every tweet until the late 2010s. I'm wondering, like, from your perspective, like, when did that goal change and why?
Well, there definitely are some initiatives that are trying to archive content. Obviously, there's the Internet Archive.
Use that a lot.
Yes, the Internet Archive is a favorite of many of us, I think, which, again, if those servers ever go down, if they lose a lawsuit, if something catastrophic happens, what happens to all of that archived material? I think people might rely on that a little bit too much. But I do think that there's just so much content. And even with data storage getting much cheaper and more efficient, it's just impossible to keep up.
We do have this history of losing or discarding or, you know, specifically curating what types of physical records, you know, remained long before the internet. So do we think that digital decay is all that different?
I think it's a little bit different because with that kind of loss of data, we are also seeing a replacement with AI garbage, which is part of what makes this moment so upsetting as a journalist and as a member of society to see. Not only is our work disappearing, but it's being replaced by these large language models, which are professionally and personally, I think, not equivalent to real human beings. So we're seeing tech companies harvesting our work, harvesting our writing, harvesting our art, and then turning it into garbage that is slowly replacing it.
But fundamentally, do you feel like it is important for the internet to last forever, at least parts of the internet to last forever? Like, do we really need every scrap of TikTok and, you know, X and, you know, people's passing thoughts and fleeting thoughts to really last?
I am definitely okay with future generations not knowing that I ate a roast beef sandwich on February 18th, 2017, right? But I do think we need to have a conversation about the fact that all data ultimately is ephemeral. Obviously, every single piece of data is not going to last forever. That would be just a wildly overwhelming amount of information. But we do need to decide what information is important to us and how we want to preserve it and how we make sure that evidence of these conversations that we had and these shifts in society is told from multiple points of view.
That's journalist S.E. Smith. S.E., thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, it was a pleasure.
It's been a week since the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas went into effect. Hundreds of aid trucks now arrive in Gaza every day. Displaced people are returning to their homes, hoping they still stand after months of bombardment. But it won't be an easy road out of the humanitarian crisis left by 15 months of war. And today, we bring you a firsthand account of those conditions as the war entered its final days.
I think like most people, I was just kind of watching it on my phone live stream, and I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't just keep watching and not do anything.
That's Mimi Syed, an emergency physician based in Washington State. She set out to find a way into Gaza to help. And after months of navigating red tape, she made two trips last year with an American NGO, most recently working in two different hospitals for the month of December. The toll on the population had become clear.
We could now see more of the aftermath of what was happening because it's been going on for so long. Very high cases of kidney failure in children, malnourishment, a lot of infectious diseases that were very preventable. Children are easier to be dehydrated or hypothermic. It's like so many layers. You can't even begin to kind of see the level of destruction.
Here, Dr. Syed shares voice memos she captured while she was there, a personal diary of sorts, which she sent to us daily. And a note to listeners, you'll be hearing the sounds of war, including gunshots and explosions, and the sounds and descriptions of wounded people being treated in a hospital.
It's December 4th. It's about 6 o'clock in the morning. And that's what we're waking up to. I arrived here last night. And this morning we'll be going to the hospital. I'll touch base then.
When?
No, when?
When? When?
So you got injured via shrapnel or gunshot? Now it's infected? Explosive injury with a hemothorax, urethral injury, chest tube, slowly difficult to insert.
I have seen more cases of malnourishment than I had previously when I was here. The temperature is a little colder as well, and I noticed that children are walking around without shoes on or jackets on. I've seen more patients come in with hypothermia because it gets very cold outside at night and there's no sheltering and no coats or jackets. Yesterday was a mass casualty incident where we received many children. One of them was a 9-year-old who had a shrapnel to her head with brain matter exposed. We would normally not resuscitate that patient. However, I made the decision to intubate her and secure her airway, resuscitate her, and I'm really glad that I did that because today she is moving around and actually showing very good neurologic function. I guess it's stories like these that make me remember why I'm here. December 6, 2024, a colleague and I stood outside today, and children started to congregate around us asking us for candy, and I had brought some lollipops with gum in it and some chocolate, and they were so happy to receive it. They asked us our names and where we were from and wanted to take selfies with us. It was really cute. It reminded me of my kids back home. This morning, I woke up and was heading down to the ER, and I noticed some kids that I've been laughing with and playing with. They're kind of just living in the encampments around the hospital and in the hospital. I woke up and saw the back of a car, the back window that's filthy with dust, but someone had kind of painted on there with their finger, "Mimi, I love you." I thought it was really sweet and kind of brightened my day. But I'm going to go try to find them and give them some balloons that I brought with me.
December 14th, 2024, this is our second mass casualty today. We had three teenagers dead on arrival and multiple injuries, severe injuries. Now we're waiting for another MCI, the same area.
December 16th, 2024, two patients came in with quadcopter shots to the head. One was a 16-year-old male who came in, pretty much unsalvageable injuries. We're just waiting for him to die. It just is, it's become a normal thing in Gaza. December 21st, 2024. On December 4th, we received a child with the ambulance that had a very severe head injury with brain matter exposed. And I just heard from the father today, and he sent me a video of her reading and also walking normally, and at the end of the video she said, "Thank you, doctor, for saving me. I'm doing well."
Shukran ya doctor. Alhamdulillah, ana bkhair.
These kids are bringing us food, and we have a whole spread that they've made, and they've invited us to dinner, and
hello,
we have a little place inside.
Hello.
Hello.
December 25th, 2024. Yesterday evening, the children that are displaced and live in the tents around the hospital and in the hospital, they prepared an entire spread of food for me and two other physicians here for Christmas Eve, kind of food given to them by the World Food Kitchen.
You cook this, Mina?
Spaghetti and beans and olives and rice.
It was just so endearing to see them prepare an entire spread for us using whatever they had, even though they barely have any food for themselves. And they were so proud of their efforts. Reminded me how innocent children are, and that children will always be children no matter what part of the world they're in. December 29, 2024, it's the day before I leave. I have many feelings. I have excitement to see my family again, but I know that I'm going to go back to my normal life that's beautiful, and I have to leave these people here, all of my colleagues and kids that I've met, the patients, and there's no end in sight. December 31st, it's the morning after I got back to Amman last night. One of the colleagues that I was with in Gaza took us out to such a fancy restaurant, such a nice restaurant. It felt like I had stepped into another dimension again. I mean, I'm still wearing the shoes with the blood of Gazans on it, and I was sitting there and I felt this overwhelming sense of guilt. And I couldn't eat a bite. I couldn't eat anything. And I've been waiting to make this voice note because I knew it would be so difficult to make. I just can't. I can't forget my colleagues that I left behind and the children, all the children that are going to be suffering. And here I am. I get to sit here and sit in safety and warmth and have clean water and good food to eat. Anyway, I hope to continue to record and document everything and speak up as much as I can in every opportunity about this situation until my very last breath.
That was Dr. Mimi Syed, an American physician who recently spent a month treating patients at hospitals in Gaza. She documented humanitarian conditions there in the final weeks before the ceasefire, conditions which are still dire today. This is NPR News. Earlier this month, theologian Richard B. Hayes died after a long battle with pancreatic cancer. The Duke Divinity School professor emeritus was best known for his 1996 book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament. One chapter in his book dealt with same-sex relationships in Christianity and was often cited by other Christians as theological grounds to exclude LGBTQ people from the church, which was a reaction that troubled Hayes.
In that book, I actually argued that gay and lesbian people should be welcome in the church. I even said that if they're not welcome in the church, I will have to walk out of the sanctuary with them, leaving only those who feel qualified to throw the first stone. But I did venture the judgment that if they were going to be in the church, they needed to remain celibate. I gradually became uneasy with what I had written, especially as I saw how what I had written was in some quarters weaponized. I think that was a misreading of what I wrote, but I left myself open to that in serious ways.
Host Scott Detrow spoke with Hayes last September about his new book, The Widening of God's Mercy. In the book, he and his son, Chris Hayes, argued the exact opposite of his previous stance, saying now that LGBTQ people should be fully embraced by the church. Hayes argued that the Bible shows how God's mercy is ever expanding to include more people, but that followers can be too caught up in the letter of the law and miss the spirit of God's commandments.
One of the themes of the New Testament chapters that I wrote in the book is that people who are conscientiously attempting to uphold what they believe to be something that's a changeless command of God actually, with all good intention, end up acting in ways that are contrary to the spirit and intent of God's commandments.
Hayes recounted a story from the Gospel of Mark. According to the Bible, a group of Pharisees is watching to see if Jesus will heal a man's withered hand. It's an act of compassion, but one that would violate laws for being performed on the Sabbath.
They're operating with a deep intention to be obedient to God's law, but Jesus is grieved at their hardness of heart. Now, I think we see things like that happening over and over in the stories of the Bible, and that the desire of God is for healing and inclusion of more and more people, and that the rigid attempt at obedience actually is operating contrary to God's will.
At the time we spoke with Hayes, he knew that his cancer had returned and spread. And despite his worry that his new book might cause a painful rupture with friends and colleagues, he wanted to correct the record about where he stood on the question of LGBTQ Christians.
You know, change is sometimes hard, but it's something that Scripture itself calls us to all the time. Repentance, the Greek word for it is metanoia, which means a change of mind. I'm concerned that it will perhaps burn some bridges and break some relationships that I've cherished. But as I age, I wanted my final word on the subject to be out there, and so there it is.
Richard B. Hayes was 76 years old. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It was one of then-candidate Trump's most popular campaign promises.
When I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
What if taxes on tips come to an end? Economists offer their takes Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israel says it won't allow Palestinians in Gaza to return to the northern part of the enclave until Hamas releases Arbel Yehud, a female civilian hostage who was not among yesterday's release of female soldiers. Israel says Hamas claims Yehud has military training, but Israel notes all citizens have to go through that. U.S. Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, or ICE, says on the social media site X that it, along with federal partners, including the FBI, ATF, DEA, and the U.S. Marshals Service, is conducting enhanced targeted operations today in Chicago to enforce U.S. immigration law. And rain is arriving in the Los Angeles area. Welcome after the devastating wildfires destroyed thousands of homes and left at least 28 people dead. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ping Huang. Michael Shannon is best known for his acting roles in everything from The Shape of Water to Boardwalk Empire, but his latest roles are not on screen. His directorial debut, Eric LaRue, is at the Spring, and before then, his REM cover band is hitting the road. He says his love of that band began as a teenager.
Feels like this band made these songs just for you when you listen to them, to help you like navigate the pain and absurdity of existence. And there's so many people that feel that way. And yet that's the thing about really incredible music, I feel, is that it's very public and very private at the same time.
Shannon delved more into his childhood on Wildcard, where guests answer big questions about their lives drawn from a deck of cards. Here's host Rachel Martin.
First three cards. Here you go. One, two, or three?
Three.
Three. What do you admire about your teenage self?
Oh, what a lovely question. Well, I was a survivor, you know. I'd say the years from like 12 to 16 were a real gauntlet. Because my mother lived in Kentucky and my father lived in Chicago, so my childhood I spent in Kentucky with my mother, but when I started high school in my adolescence, I moved up to live with my father. In that period of time is when I started getting into acting, and I guess I had some guts to get into that. Showing up and, you know, auditioning for the school play and getting little opportunities to do that. And then, you know, after I got out of high school, I was still a teenager and I was in Chicago, and I started going down into the city and auditioning for plays in the city, and started getting parts in, you know, very small, like storefront theater productions. And that took a fair amount of guts, I think.
It does take a lot of courage to stand up on a stage and try to inhabit another character at that age. It takes guts.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe I didn't feel like I had much to lose, you know? It was like, it didn't really matter, I guess, at the end of the day, whether they thought I was, you know, good or not. It really didn't make a difference.
Three more. One, two, or three?
One.
What does age teach you about love?
Oh, my God. Oh, dear.
Oh, no. Is that a good, oh, my God, or a bad one?
No, it just moved me. I think, you know, when you're young, love is very self, can be very self-serving. You're like, you want love from other people. You want to have love. It's something you want for yourself. And then as you get older, you realize that it's probably ultimately more important to love others regardless of what you get in return.
Yeah.
It becomes hopefully less transactional and more just a state of being, yeah. You know, which is can be hard to accept.
I don't think that comes naturally to any of us, is that recognition and being able to then take people where they're at, love without expecting some reciprocity.
Well, and it's liberating in a way, if you can really do it in an honest, authentic way, it's actually very freeing. But it, unfortunately, it seems to be something you can't get to without experiencing a fair amount of pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Three more in this round. One, two, or three?
Three.
Three. Was there a bedrock truth in your life that you found out wasn't true?
I don't think so. You know, I guess the most bedrock truth I could claim to have is that, you know, change is the only reality, mm-hmm. but it does actually seem to be true.
Are you comfortable in that? I mean, has it always been?
Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. But I can't imagine it any other way. You know, when you act, you create these little societies or civilizations to create some piece of art, and then you finish and they disappear. But for the most part, you get very accustomed to things not being, you know, stable or reliable or things changing, mm-hmm. you know.
How does having a family play into that? Is that a constant for you?
That is, yeah. Particularly my daughters. I mean, that's the one thing, you know, that won't change is I love them very much, and I always will, and they're my, you know, favorite people, and I'm fascinated by them, and if they're anything like me, there'll probably be a period of time where I don't interact with them very much. You know, so
are you preparing yourself for that?
Yeah, well, my 16-year-old is already a very cosmopolitan young woman. Yeah, but she's so healthy. I mean, it's all so healthy,
yeah.
And it's exactly what should be happening. And
but that's a great thing, because you had a different experience with your parents, and I imagine it informed your choices about how you wanted to raise kids. And
yeah, I get uncomfortable taking too much credit for it, but I, you know, I also make tons of mistakes, just like everybody.
Nah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Me either. Perfect.
Come on. You heard it here on NPR.
Michael Shannon's new movie, Eric LaRue, will be out this spring. You can see him on tour covering REM's Fables of the Reconstruction album this winter. Michael, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You can follow NPR's Wildcard podcast to hear a longer version of that conversation. Slide over, human judges. AI has entered the fold for the 2025 X Games in Aspen, Colorado. This is the first time AI is being introduced to snowboarding events, and it's a trial run, but it's expected to bring greater objectivity in scoring. Jeremy Bloom is with us. He's CEO of the X Games, and he's here to explain more. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
For those who are unfamiliar with the X Games scoring system, can you explain how human judges award their scores and how AI will be different?
Sure. It's based off the amplitude, based off the difficulty of the trick, and the precision of the landing. Those are the three main categories of human judging, and we use those three main categories to program the AI as well.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're saying AI is actually quite similar to how the humans are judging it.
Yes. When we were building and training the model, we put thousands of hours of snowboarding content into the model. We uploaded the exact criteria. And through that evolution, we gave it different prompts to sort of calibrate it to make sure that it was seeing those runs correctly.
You've said that objectivity in scoring is one of the main goals here. I'm wondering how objectivity is lacking now.
You know, I come from the world of judge sports. I've been in it my whole life. I was a two-time Olympic skier for Team USA for freestyle. And so I've seen firsthand as a competitor, sometimes, you know, humans get it wrong. But also as a former football player in the NFL, I also saw referees lose games for us.
In this weekend's broadcast, the AI judge was represented by this owl with snow goggles that, you know, popped up on the screen as this automated voice talks through the score that it gave.
I'm giving that run an 84.75. It was the insane backside alley.
One X Games fan on Reddit said that they were expecting stats and metrics about the tricks, but saw instead a quote, cringy AI impression of an X Games announcer. So I'm wondering, what was the intended effect?
You know, people aren't always ready for change or think that change is a good idea. If you're somebody who really, you know, dreams of the future, of course, not everybody is going to, you know, see those things as good ideas. Of course, you know, we'll listen. Absolutely. We'll listen to our fans. And I can tell you the athletes here loved it and they're so curious about it. They actually want to use it for coaching as well, to have a second set of eyes on the hill to help them understand, you know, why did you judge it that way? And what could I do as an athlete to make that trick better? So our athletes are pretty fired up about it.
I wanted to ask you about the athlete part of it. I mean, you're a former Olympic skier, professional football player, as you said. So of course, you know firsthand that judging an athlete's performance can be really difficult and complex, and the AI technology isn't perfect yet. Does that concern you, given that the stakes in competition can be really high for these athletes?
No, it excites me, because I think this technology can see way more than the human eye, and the technology can index every run that's ever been done before. You know, we've had several leagues reach out now and are interested in using the OWL across their sports. And really excited to begin those conversations with other commissioners and other CEOs of other sport leagues to see how we could use our technology to help their athletes and teams as well.
Jeremy Bloom is CEO of the X Games. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nearly 2 billion people are set to celebrate Lunar New Year Wednesday and the Year of the Wood Snake. There are all kinds of customs and traditions that come with the holiday. Families gather to reflect, and there's food and fireworks to fend off legendary, mythical beasts. One of the staples of Lunar New Year celebrations around the world is the Lion Dance. Two people dressed in a long, colorful lion costume are dancing in lockstep with high-energy choreography. It's an art that dates back to the Han Dynasty and is said to bring good fortune and ward off evil spirits, but it is hard to pull off. Grace Yeo found out firsthand. She's a correspondent for Channel News Asia, and she spent a full month with former global lion dance champions, the Singapore Yue Athletic Association.
I wanted to try the physical aspects of it. So that's like actually being either the lion head or tail and then going on the stilts. But because it was just a month and I didn't have any prior experience before that, so I only tried the musical instruments. But even that was harder than I expected. I think a lot of people underestimate the importance of being on beat and having a sense of rhythm. I tried the cymbals and as well as the gong. It didn't follow the usual 5, 6, 7, 8 kind of dance rhythm that I was used to with my dance background. So for lion dance, the rhythm is not like that at all.
And so with the music, are there scores that people do? Is there a specific beat? Like, is there a message embedded in the, you know, the clash of the cymbals and the banging of the drums?
Yeah, because according to legend, the banging of the drums and all that was meant to chase away bad luck, if I'm not mistaken. But in terms of when I was learning, there wasn't so much, like, say, a physical paper in front of me to show me what beat do I hit the cymbals on. A lot of it was very intuitive, which I struggled a lot with, but I was also very impressed that these boys that I was training with could pick up these things so easily. It was very natural to them, like to just listen to the rhythm and to internalize it.
Yeah, so it sounds like there is a particular, you know, rhythm and beat that is, you know, driving the lion dance. And let's talk about how that meshes with the choreography. So as we mentioned, there's two people, one costume. How does that work? And is there like a specific design to the steps that they're taking?
They would tell me things like, okay, we're going to move the lion head in a certain way, and then that is supposed to convey like a little bit of a playfulness or a cheeky vibe. And then sometimes the lion would move a little bit slowly to indicate, you know, that they convey some sense of being coy. But then again, it's also very much based on the individual lion dancers themselves, because different people would have a different kind of dance style. And when I was there, they did mention that the partners, so both head and tail, have to kind of understand each other's body movement and rhythm in order to come up with what actions would feel most natural to them.
Yeah, I mean, that gets me to my next point, which is the crowd work. I mean, like, yeah. When you see a lion dance in a parade or at a celebration, like, it is a very interactive experience. You know, the lion is winking at you or coming up to you and, you know, yeah, taking things from your hand. So tell me about those interactions with the crowd. Like, what types of interactions might the lion have?
The way I notice them with the crowd is, I guess maybe they'll pick out a certain member in the crowd who's exceptionally transfixed onto the lion. Then they will saunter over, kind of tease the crowd member a little bit, you know, drop some oranges or like nudge the crowd member with the lion's head. Things that will convey some sort of playfulness, I think, and things that the other crowd members watching will laugh at. I think that's always a crowd pleaser. Anything that makes everyone else laugh.
That's journalist Grace Yeo talking about the lion dance. For Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ping Huang. Thanks for listening. We'll talk soon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
Thank you. places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes. I spent my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. Yeah. Well, we're alone now, and I'm singing a song for you.